Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and welcome to episode 92, The Hidden Globe. Our guest today is Atoussa Araxian-Ibrahimian, author of the aforementioned book, The Hidden Globe, the critically acclaimed dive into the parallel world of zones, and so much more. And so we're delighted to have Atoussa on, as she is one of the world's, frankly, foremost journalists and scholars of all of these crazy interstitial spaces of exclusion and exemption out there. So thanks for joining us, Atoussa.
It is so my pleasure and long overdue.
Well, we'll dive into it. There's so much to cover in current events alone, but obviously having an author on the show, could you please tell our listeners what is The Hidden Globe about and the way it intersects with space and the built environment?
Yeah, so The Hidden Globe is a book about all of the places in the world that don't quite fit. From a legal perspective, from a territorial perspective. So it's easier to just give examples. The first notable place that I start in is Geneva Freeport, which is a warehouse in Geneva, but not of Geneva, right? The laws there are a little bit different. And they are such that they allow the very wealthy people to store vast amounts of art and wine and cars and all of the rich people things. It's like mini storage, but for billionaires. So we start there and then go out into the world. There's a chapter on the oceans. There is a chapter on special economic zones, these industrial sites that are outside of customs territory that are often deregulated. There's a chapter on outer space, actually, by way of Luxembourg. And I also visit a border town between Laos and China, an Arctic archipelago called Svalbard, which is technically Norwegian, but has truly open borders if you can get there and, you know, stay alive in the Arctic tundra, and many other places that are, you know, similarly liminal or ambiguous or make us rethink the relationship between land and law and people and, you know, territory.
Amazing. Well, I think we're going to get into zones, to say the least. But as a starting place, can you talk a bit more about the Geneva Freeport and what it actually looks like? What are these zones? Because I think the introduction for the layperson was probably Tenet, I believe, which actually has a heist or something happening in one of those spaces. But what is it actually like from a built perspective? Because really, it's the code, it's the legality that justifies its existence. So does anyone actually invest in the place itself?
Yeah, there isn't really too much to write home about if you see the Geneva Freeport from outside, and I have many times because I grew up really near it in Geneva. And it's just a building. Like, there's really nothing remarkable about it. There's no notable architecture. There's nothing, you know, it's next to a bus depot, like for public transit. So you can very easily walk by and not think twice about it. What's unique about the Geneva Freeport is that you will notice when you go there are guards outside, which in Geneva is not that unusual. Like, a lot of boutiques have guards outside. There's like a velvet rope outside the Rolex store in Geneva, and bouncers. But, you know, there are guards, and it's you can tell that it's somehow armored. Like, you can't just walk in. And heavens knows I've tried. Of all the places that I write about in the book, the one that I couldn't get into was the one that I grew up 5 minutes from. So that tells you something. And I think this, you know, unremarkable nature of the Geneva Freeport is really interesting and important, because inside it, there's all kinds of stuff. And it's actually much more sophisticated than you'd think, because people store artworks that are delicate, wines that need to be climate controlled. Like, there is a very specific, like, set of environmental conditions that allow these things to stick around there forever. I think it's important now to talk a teeny bit about how the Geneva Freeport came about, because it actually has a lot, the loopholeness of it all has a lot to do with environmental conditions. So back in the day, when Geneva was like a trading hub and an entrepot, and people were bringing shipments of grain and, you know, perishables from one country to another, or from one place to another, they'd stop through Geneva, they'd go to the market, they'd sell their wares, but they'd need somewhere to leave their things overnight or longer on their journey somewhere else to sell them somewhere else. And the Freeport offered a place to do that without what people would now characterize as red tape and bureaucracy. I don't know that they had red tape or bureaucracy per se there, but they're, you know, you're storing things, you have to like declare customs. That allowed you to wait to not do that. And the operative thing here is that there were time limits, because There were time limits on the materials that were being transported. You can't just leave a grain silo full of grain to just be there forever. It's going to go bad. You're going to lose your goods. It's not you, no one would want that. It's a very different story for like a gold bar or something else like money or bearer bonds or something that it doesn't really deteriorate. Of course, some of these things do deteriorate, which is why they created these conditions. But what I'm trying to say is that the rules that allowed for grain to pass through unimpeded, including the lack of sort of time limits, carried through over through the ages and now apply to things that where it makes no sense at all. And so things will stick around in this warehouse for, indefinitely, really. They could stick around indefinitely. And nothing is preventing them from doing it.
Really interesting. I'm wondering what some of, so we know that the basically the objective of a lot of these places is discretion, right? The idea is to avoid detection, and that is actually part of their marketing is to let people know that their goods are safe and that they are outside of normal custom law. My understanding is that some of these in the interiors of some of these spaces, they have changed to be they've decided it was a business approach to make it more of a high-end experience, much like a gallery, as opposed to a Home Depot full of really, really expensive stuff. And you did get into one of those, didn't you?
Yeah, I went into one of these. I want to call this pseudo free port because they were trying to market it as a free port in Harlem, in New York. But there were like no tax advantages, right? The whole thing is if you say free port, you hear tax breaks. That's the subtext for all of this. This pair of entrepreneurs tried to open one of these in Harlem. They were pitching it as a free port, but it wasn't in any way useful for, money. What they were offering was like incredible climate control, humidity control, just like super high-end everything. I visited and I had to get my like retina scan just to go inside on a visit as a journalist. And there was nothing in it at the time. It didn't even opened. So it was really like it's a lot of theater, to be honest. And it's a lot of theater that you will see in, as Greg pointed out, the movie Tenet. The whole preamble when the Freeport management shows the protagonist into it is this is extra secure. Like, we only want this is completely legal. This is so clean. You could eat off the floor. That's like very accurate, a very, very accurate portrayal of how these spaces sort of market themselves and how they're kind of the people that work there comport themselves too.
Well, I want to pull the camera back here for on the loophole perspective because you mentioned the word loopholes, and I feel like loopholes is the theme that runs through both of your books. Your earlier book, The Cosmopolites, focused for listeners, focused on the arise of citizenship for sale, and particularly brokers like Henley and Partners and others that would help nation states like Malta and others arrange the sale of passports with incredibly crazy externalities. So it's like from the externalities of goods to externalities of people. My favorite part of the Hidden Globe, the part where I like ate my heart out as a fellow journalist, is when you secured interviews with the architect of DIFC. And DIFC is the Dubai International Finance Center. DIFC, for those who are not in the know, master planned by Gensler, highest rents in Dubai. Nothing to do with the architecture or master plan, but the fact that it has a completely separate legal system. And so, Tusa, I wonder if you could talk about that because I feel like that is a landmark in the advent and evolution of zones that is underappreciated. And what are the implications of DIFC and as it carries forward?
So DIFC has existed for about 25 years now, 20, 25 years now. And if you're familiar with the sort of top bar legal geography of the UAE, UAE is full of these free zones. Starting early version of this was the port at Jebel Ali, lots of free zones. And they have all these very like cute, healthcare city and like media city, and they just kind of brand. It's a lot of branding, right? There are some concessions, there are some, easier to like start a business if you're a foreigner sort of laws, but like it's really heavy on the branding, and it's really heavy on this idea that like you have a cluster of professionals in the same space who are, contributing knowledge and like interacting and what, that whole idea. And there's something to be said for it. Like we all realized that during the pandemic, it's nice to have a cluster. But the DIFC was unique in two ways. One is that it was truly geared towards finance companies, towards international financial institutions. And so Deutsche Bank and like all the big banks have sort of an outpost there. And the second is that they didn't stop at just the regulatory environment that allowed or disallowed certain activities. They actually established their own court within the DIFC. And initially, it was sort of a court for the tenants. So it was physically grounded in the DIFC itself. You know, high rents mean the clientele were not coming off the street and like complaining about their pitiful wages. Although in theory, that could have been the case, right? You could have had an employee dispute go to the court there in the early days. So what began as a court for this real estate development, which was quite large and had a lot of tenants, then evolved into an opt-in jurisdiction for anybody anywhere. Didn't matter if you had a single, if you never even thought about Dubai in your life, you could opt into this jurisdiction, which is pretty crazy. And the way that that happened is that after the financial crisis, Dubai World or DP World, I always mix up what it was called at the time, the big sovereign wealth fund that was from Dubai that was investing in tons of stuff all around the world, went under, and all of the creditors started to ask for their money back. And the government of Dubai decided, well, let's just bring them all to the same place. And let's establish a court that allows them all to have their day, you know, in a centralized way. We'll have judges, we'll just like bring it all home, which was pretty smart because, you know, first of all, on a really like day-to-day level, when you have all this litigation, that's a ton of money. These are lawyers with expense accounts and hotel rooms, and like you may be giving up some money to your creditors, but you are also bringing lots of humans with fat wallets to your city. So that was a smart move. That's why cities love to have these commercial courts, by the way. You see them pop up in global cities around the world. But the second, and I don't even know like how intentional this was, in hearing all of these cases within the confines of the DIFC court, the court was able to prove that it wasn't a kangaroo court, you know, presided over by the emir or by the sheikh of Dubai. It actually had what appears, you know, I have no reason to doubt that they gave everyone a fair shake, that they were pretty impartial, that the due process, blah, blah, blah. And from there, they had an amazing amount of credibility after this, and were able to establish themselves as an alternative that is within the Dubai court, the legal system of the Emirates, but somehow outside of it, right? And the person that really launched this and that really like conceptualized it was this fellow, Mark Beer, who I had a brunch with and talked to on the phone a few times. And he's a really interesting character because, you know, he's someone, I don't think he was from a particularly fancy British background. Like he started off carrying bags at a law firm, always wanted to be a lawyer, kind of scrappy, you know, charming, went to law school, studied jurisprudence, et cetera, ended up in the canton of Schwyz in Switzerland, which is like kind of obscure, but a tax haven, doing corporate stuff, moved to Dubai, worked for MasterCard. And at this moment, when he became interested in like free zones and laws, was offered an opportunity to actually start his court from scratch, which is bananas if you think about like, what is law? Like you can just start a court. Actually, you can. And from there, the DIFC was able to use this court to really like step it up, you know, to offer something that other free zones didn't have. To go back to the built environment of the court, though, there's not much. It's not a courthouse. There's nothing grand about it. It's a conference, a boardroom conference room. You know, it's like corporate. It's not.
And it doesn't have to necessarily be anywhere. It's not place-based, right? It's tied to the sovereignty of the UAE, but not actually has to be present the UAE. So what are the implications of that? And like, this is where we could perhaps go to the present here, because the ongoing evolution of the zone as the zone metastasizes and loopholes sprout within loopholes, what was the significance of the fact that you can now have an unanchored but nominally sovereign was the phrase I was looking for?
So it's both, because like all of these deterritorialized things need some kind of anchor on earth to have sign off from a sovereign, however nominally. So in this case, there's sign off from Dubai which governs its own legal system. Meanwhile, the judges, the proceedings, are for the most part on Zoom or whatever version of it they use. And if you really want to like cure your insomnia, you can go on YouTube and just like watch the videos. To their credit, okay, and this, I maybe should have made more of this in the book. Most of the time, people who want to go through alternative legal channels to resolve a dispute will go into arbitration, and it is a black box, and you and I will never hear about it. We will maybe know that it happened and that someone won, but like very, very little transparency unless it gets kicked back into a national court that then, you know, if it's very, very contentious. In this case, they're like putting their business up on Zoom for anyone to watch, which is really interesting and really boring because the majority of these cases are not like, this is not John Grisham shit. This is like contractual disputes between like, you know, it's not interesting, substantively all that interesting. So, yeah.
One of my favorite things about Fiona Apple is she's a devoted court watcher. So I feel like there's a challenge here, which like the Fiona Apple DIFC challenge, but but I want to talk about, let's go to current events here out of this because, yeah, so I mean, the zones have just sort of multiplied. The Dubai zones became the model for like the Saudi zones, what we're seeing with NEOM now. I think of the Cosmopolites as well because the Estonians created e-residency. And I know at one point the Estonians were consulting for the Saudis about creating citizenship carve-outs for NEOM, which were discussed. And now we had two episodes ago, we had Kate Wagner on to talk about nominally the reconstruction plans of Gaza. And now the President of the United States has stepped in, perhaps to build a freedom city or a charter city or a praxis city. It's really fascinating how the last few years, these entrepreneurial startup zones. And so I guess I'm curious from both what you've seen since the book has been published, there's been incredible advances in this. And why is it the fact that Trump keeps coming back to zones like Greenland, adjacent to Svalbard, and the Panama Canal zone, and so forth?
Yeah. I really was spending the first month of the Trump administration wrapping my head around this because I kept noticing, I was like, okay, he really wants to buy the Panama Canal or he wants to take it back and he wants Greenland and he's talking about Gaza and he's talking about freedom cities in the US and it just goes on and on and on. And I was like, wait, but I know about all, I've been thinking about all of these things and now it's all happening. It's all very confusing. And so, okay, so my what I'm calling this ideology or this sort of approach to foreign policy is national globalism. It's not globalist, right? These guys talk a big game. They hate globalists. They don't want to spend. That's not true. They see all of the advantages of having an international presence. And they also like to talk about their sovereignty and nationalism and how wonderful the United States is and how important the borders are. These things might seem contradictory, but they're really not if you think of sovereignty as something that only matters for you and not for other people. It also makes sense if you think of their incursions into these liminal, like let's just call them liminal spaces for the sake of argument. We can get back into why they're not always that way later. You can see why they would seize upon these places because they're soft targets, right? They're vulnerable. The Panama Canal, like, yeah, it's Panamanian, but it wasn't always. And like the US built it and operated it. Greenland, also, like, yeah, it's Danish, but like, do they want to be? Are they fully? Guantanamo Bay. It's Cuban, but not. It's American, but not. The US is leasing it against Cuba's will. So it's like, by definition, a kind of indeterminate jurisdiction. And I think for someone, for a national globalist, you can use all of this extraterritorial space and indeed engage with the world very, like, profound. I mean, very meaningfully, I just mean in terms of the effect it can have, while making your nationalist claims and advancing your nationalist ideologies. So I don't, something that I'm very adamant about is that these things are not incompatible at all. Now, Gaza is an interesting case, right? Because the people who live in Gaza would not characterize their home as like liminal or indeterminate or like somehow a zone. They're like, no, this is our home. We are Palestinian. This is Palestine. But over the past, you know, 60, 70 years, world leaders have bent themselves backwards to try to somehow characterize it as liminal or indeterminate. And the Israelis absolutely have been doing this too. So it's just kind of an interesting, it's interesting that this has stuck to the point that now Trump thinks that it's, you know, I don't know, that maybe he thinks it's an opportunity zone and he's confused. Like, this is a guy who has built real estate projects on these kinds of concessions and loopholes. So there's a logic to it, right?
Do you think his next building site might be in Boten, between Laos and China? This liminal zone that was a city of sin that you visited, which is now sort of a, I don't know how you would characterize it.
The world capital of pig butchering scams?
Yeah.
You know, not even. It's really like, it's pretty bleak and there isn't even that much going on there. It's not like the Golden Triangle Zone, which really is the capital of all kinds of nasty things. But Boten, I mean, Boten is a stop on the Lao-China Railway. That is its defining feature. And that is the only way it's going to make anything of itself. And that's not nothing. I wish we could make more of more places with a high-speed railway. You know, good for them. They got the right idea. That said, Boten is pretty depressing, right? It's a skeleton. But when I saw it was a skeleton city. You guys, I'm sure, have encountered way more of these than I have. But is Trump going to build there? Well, the Chinese developers that are there have really, like, strong influence. There's Chinese cops, there's Chinese, every license plate is Chinese. You can barely buy a beer with Lao money. You know, you gotta use Chinese apps or money. And so I think that if Trump built something there, it would either mean that we got to a place where, like, China and the US were totally cool, or he was about to start a war. And there's nothing in between.
Well, conversely, what's the flip side of that one? I mean, if you expand this further, given the fact that there's this discussion that, you know, that China is just sitting back and waiting for the United States to exert all of its remaining energies and then a sort of ascend into the global hegemon, what is the zones of the Belt and Road system look like? Because this is an example of one, right? If they continue Belt and Road, like, we can imagine a shadowy realm of the China, of the Sinosphere, as part of their whole thing as well, too. How do you see these sort of these contestations? You have Gulf zones, you have American zones. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, every zone is its own special snowflake, right? Because they do exist in the geographic and political context they're in. They are in a country for the most part. So every local leader, national leader involved in it will bring their own kind of demands and requirements to the table. But basically, it's more deregulation. It's I think it does make import-export, that sort of thing, easier. The storage is easier. You know, they're pretty, it's a lot of, like, flattening or sort of homogenizing of regulation. There's 50, and you say Belt and Road, but there's like 50 of these in Africa and the African continent, Sri Lanka, you know, Indian Ocean. There's just a lot of these popping up. And I don't know that we can say anything definitive about how they're all this way, or they're all like this, or they're all like that. But, well, I guess I can say with confidence that they are all ostensibly better for business.
Well, speaking of which, I'd love, what is the ideology or the ideological history of the Hidden Globe? Because also Switzerland, home of the Mont Pelerin Society, right there on the lake as well. But I want to zone in on two things, so to speak. One, I believe it's in Keller Easterling's Extra Statecraft, which stands alongside this book, I think, in many ways, is I think she noted a UN study that goes back to almost the 1940s, that the rise of zones was meant to be the sort of accelerant for the local economies. But even the UN, after endorsing them, found that they were parasites on their local economies. So, which I think is then interesting, because then you see this breed of economists, you know where I'm going with this, but breed of economists like Paul Collier, who published reports arguing they should build zones in the Dominican Republic for Haitians. And then, of course, in 2008, 2009, you have Paul Romer, now Nobel Prize winning Paul Romer, proposing the charter city, which you finally also get an interview with Paul, which I never managed to do. So jealous of you.
But you went to Honduras with Paul.
No, Paul did not talk to me for my piece in Honduras. I talked to his lieutenants, I talked to his fellow travelers, but Paul remained separate from the fray. But interestingly enough, Paul sort of wryly dismisses that his idea has been co-opted by the crypto boys, which I would also love to hear your thoughts on. But it's interesting to hear you describe national globalism, because this really started as like arch neoliberalism, like peak neoliberalism. And I'm curious if that's changed, or if it was always this way, or whether, you know, whether zones are determined to be this. So the Hidden Globe is always going to be this place of deregulation, mm-hmm, and innovation.
Well, the sort of deep history of it is that, like, before we had nation states as we know them, the world was full of these things. And they just kind of, I don't know, I don't think that there were, you know, a bunch of old men with Teutonic accents rubbing their hands together on a mountaintop. Like, this kind of came out of, like, messy organized ways of organizing society under, like, the Roman Empire and, you know, subsequent empires. that were full of holes and you know,
Hanseatic League, and yeah,
Hanseatic League, right? Which isn't to say that these structures didn't then inspire the neoliberal thinkers. Like, they pretty directly did, especially this idea of like a free trade zone, of a free commerce zone. And, you know, notably, this did not include the free movement of people most of the time. It was really like focused on money and goods. So I think the ideology of the zone, I think that before I'd written the book, I would have given you a much more confident and like damning answer. But I think that a lot of the time, the idea of a zone is definitely like, on the one hand, very like development economics, you know, bring in, you know, business to the shores of a poor country and they will do better. There's a touch of, you know, law and economics, where like the function of law and regulation is to create better economies rather than to bring about justice. Neoliberalism, of course, that is also the global context in which these, you know, rose to prominence. But the sort of wild card here is that, like, like I said, each zone is a special snowflake, but they do kind of arise in like kind of contingent ways sometimes. Like DIFC, maybe not the DIFC itself, but like the core, like a lot of these things really do happen in an interesting kind of chaotic way. Ideologically speaking, though, again, like there's some consistency there, which is like really free markets, you know, make things easy for business. Make it easy. Yeah, the sort of the globalization of the kind of globalization that was dominant in the 90s, as opposed to what we're seeing now. They haven't gone away, but that's what gave rise to them. And that's also what gave rise to their spread, as enabled by the UN system. You said that the UN had denounced them ultimately, but it hasn't stopped prescribing them. And in fact, when you look at the IMF and the World Bank, some of these agencies actually made loans contingent on the adoption of zones within a country. So it really became, if you want my personal opinion, I don't think you can discount the desire of like bureaucrats and consultants to seem like they A, know what they're doing, and B, doing something. And a zone emerged as like a thing that you could say, oh, well, let's try that. Because there was all this theory behind it, because economists had looked into it, because it seemed like very neat spatial fix that made everyone a little bit happy. And so beyond the like ideological implications of it, I think there was just something like deeply depressing and bureaucratic about it, that like you've got a bunch of guys sitting in Geneva, you've got a bunch of guys sitting in Washington, D.C. The dominant ideology is the sort of Washington consensus. This fits. Let's slap a zone on it.
All right, well, then I have to ask here, because this has been a hobby horse of mine for at least a decade as well, too. You know, we're an architecture and urbanism podcast, and architects, of course, believe they make the world. And you've just listed, and in your book, you talk to legal creators and economists and other people who are none of whom are architects. What would be your advice be to that profession, or what are the lessons to take away from this? Because, yes, this ability to write code, whether legal systems or blockchains or anything, as seems to have superseded the ability to intervene in the built environment itself. And I'm curious your thoughts on like what this means for the built environment and those who build it, whether they should be building zones, but do they need to acquire the skills and expertise to even understand what's happening here, because McKinsey consultants otherwise writing the briefs?
Yeah, well, maybe we should talk about the DIFC, because yes, it's a legal regime, and yes, it has all of these, you know, draws that they've designed to bring in business, but like it is also a place. And it has a feel, and it has a built environment. And, you know, when I visited, I must have walked around the DIFC for hours. I definitely got my 10,000 steps in. It was hot outside, too. And in a place like Dubai, that's really, I used to look down on people who were like, I go for walks at the mall. I was like, what? Why would you do such a thing? But then I've always lived in relatively temperate climates. I've never like had to, or like I haven't lived in the suburbs. I haven't lived in places, I've lived in cities. And if you don't have a city that is temperate that you can walk around in, you're going to want to walk around somewhere. And like the DIFC is honestly great, super entertaining. There's a mosque. You can go to a beauty parlor. You can eat at restaurants. Like you really have a whole universe within this complex, and it's big, you know. Get your exercise, there's gyms, there's all kinds of Emirati propaganda in there too. And so you can, and I'm not sure that you could, like, UAE is mostly desert, And what they could have done is just drawn like a big circle and then like zone, but then it wouldn't have had the same effect, right? Obviously. So I do think the architecture contributes, but I think maybe the built environment is downstream from the legal environment.
I will note for listeners, if you're having trouble imagining DIFC, if you're fans of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, there is an iconic Tom Cruise pump double fist pumping run in a sandstorm past the arch that is DIFC. But
Or you can just go to Hudson Yards and imagine it like much bigger.
that's
And
not a
that's
rec
it.
not a recommendation at Tuso, but thank you for that one, Dan.
Well, you know, the other thing, and again, I'm usually trying to steer the conversation more toward the built environment, but you know, just because so much is going on in geopolitics and economics, just in the last month or two, you know, one question that came up is with all the tariffs that are being proposed. That's a very anti-globalist and you know, for many people, an anti-business and catastrophic proposition. How does that affect the zone world? Like, how would zones react to a world that had intermittent volleys of very high tariffs, kind of like the return to the late 19th century?
So interesting little history lesson. In the US has what are called foreign trade zones, and these arose as a direct reaction to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the early 20th century. Massive tariffs, bad for America, ultimately, pain in the ass for business. And so they created these zones, these areas, initially at ports of entry, physically at ports of entry, because I think it actually psychologically like eased the transition. It's like more palatable to have something that's a little bit foreign if it's like at a port or at an airport, right? Because it's already a little bit foreign. It's not just in the middle of nowhere. Now these things can be in an office park in the middle of Kansas, and it's the same designation, right? But initially, they, you know, Staten Island had what it was really kind of entry points that were deregulated with regards to certain tariffs and that allowed either shipments to go through the United States and later for manufacturing to take place where the goods arrived were turned into something else and were imported at that tariff rate. So like if there's a tariff on steel but not on, I don't know, washing machines, there probably will be. But like for the sake of argument, if there's a tariff on steel but not of washing machines, you bring the steel into the, you know, the zone. You have people build a washing machine, you import the washing machine, you don't pay as much money. And they would argue you bring jobs back to the United States. Are these going to be good jobs? What are the costs going to look like? You know, that is all. I defer to the economists, but from my perspective, it doesn't seem like it's going to achieve what the Trump administration wants. But this kind of spatial carve out to like have it both ways was exactly the point when zones were adopted. And I think, you know, there is an important exemption where if it's a national security tariff, then like none of this can apply. So we'll see what he does with that. But my hunch is that there will be more creative use of zones to just deal with these tariffs if they do end up hitting.
So there is opportunity to build out some more good walking malls and shopping opportunities that are in liminal areas. Tariff-free, I can just see that being a huge appeal.
You make it sound so depressing, Dan. Why? Don't you
Well,
want to live in this world?
I would enjoy, I also enjoy a quick question. If you were to build a zone today, if you were to build a zone, where would you build it, Atusa? Because you have a great funny aside in there that all of these zones appear to have been built on fishing villages. This was the great 1970s template of take a fishing village and slap a zone on it. I mean, yeah, well, we see zones open up here. There's been lots of speculation, at least in the United States, of, you know, bringing Foxconn to Wisconsin and others about whether we could see basically like, you know, a Gulag archipelago, not to be over not to be over alarmist here, but equivalent of this, of imagining these camps. Yeah, I mean, what do you expect the evolution of the zone will look like in a global north perspective?
I think we're gonna see that's a good question. I think we're gonna see more of these like zones with legal systems inside of them. I think that's gonna spread to a point. I think that in the US, you know, there are so many of them already that I don't know that there's gonna be like way more of them, but I do think that we're gonna see cities with special concessions. And we can call them zones or charter cities or smart cities, or you guys know better than I do about all of these exotic designations that cities can have now, but freedom cities even. I think we're going to see some of that. I mean, there was even a Democrat, Jake Auchincloss from Massachusetts has spoken out in favor of making charter cities in the U.S. With certain, you know, specifications that are pro-business or whatever. I don't really know what the specifics are of what he wants. So I think we're going to see that. I think we might see some bipartisan agreement there, for better or for worse. And, you know, elsewhere, it's hard to say. It's hard to say if other countries are going to get on board with the Trump stuff, or they're going to react to it. Like, I'm not really sure. But yeah, I think we can expect more permutations.
All right, well, while we're asking you to talk about the future, not to end on a explicitly dark note, but also, obviously, your first book really delved into arguably the future of citizenship. And again, the United States now has a president who has plans to revoke birth citizenship for United States citizens, engaged in massive deportations. But also, there's this scramble among at least the well-to-do set of having backup citizenships. I already had two conversations today about people who are going to look into their Irish passports again. I'm a Canadian permanent resident. I moved during Trump 1. What do you think the future of citizenship holds? Because we've seen the European Commission try to crack down on Malta and others there too, but will we see more fractional citizenship? Will we see more programs like Estonia? I'm renewing my e-residency just in case. Mm-hmm. What do you anticipate there?
Citizenship by investment, aka buying passports, I think it's here to stay. I think there's going to be options. I was just talking about this, that when citizenship by investment became a thing, right, when it's got out of the back pages of the FT and the Economist and into the mainstream, into like airline magazines and, you know, Wall Street Journal ads, it was explicitly targeted at UHNWIs. And I remember attending conferences and they were saying, this is for your UHNW, ultra high net worth individuals. Now I see, and I have seen this, the threshold is coming down. So it's for the merely wealthy. More and more people who want a plan B, who see the writing on the wall, who are scared, who just want options. And I think from there, it's going to actually trickle down, for lack of a better term. And there will be options at many different price points. Fun fact is that Turkish citizenship by investment is by far the most popular. They did the most numbers in recent years. And it's in the five figures, not six figures. So that's an interesting data point, I think. I think it's definitely going to become more affordable. I mean, I'm with you. I've had so many people come up to me at parties and say, what do I do to sound like?
Well, also, it's interesting that they'll migrate back to get together again. And you probably don't want to talk too much about this, but I do think it's interesting that the most, let's just say, design and cosplay of all the charter cities groups is Praxis, which, you know, is scheming to basically try to build a city, I think, in the Mediterranean. But they even have their steel visa. Like, they've already art directed their mark of citizenship as part of this. And then, of course, you have the network state. You have Srinivasan and these others there, too. Do you think we'll see the rise of cloud nations? I mean, I guess as a way to frame, to close this conversation, because you've been so game is where does it end? Like, you know, you have a chapter on space. I mean, does the hidden globe eventually consume the obvious one, the illuminated one? Or, you know, do the loopholes continue into loopholes forever? Where do you see this stopping?
Yeah, no, I mean, my favorite, like, thing to say, because I probably repeated it too many times, that space is the ultimate offshore, right? Ultimate. And I guess Elon Musk knows this too, so it must be true. I think that space is going to be a big zone for these guys. Praxis is an interesting question because, like, arguably it's not anything. It's all spin. They haven't built anything. Their funding is highly contingent. I guess they have a graphic designer and, like, an event planner. And, you know, I don't really know if there's a there there.
And a former prime minister of Canada on the consulting payroll, according to New York Times.
He's still. Oh, boy. Well. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not holding my breath for the Mediterranean hero nation to rise from, you know, don't hold your breath. but people have always tried to do a version of this, and people will always try to do a version of this. And this is just like the really fucking like stupid version that we get now. This is like, these are, this is the one we deserve, guys. Like, Praxis is the startup nation we deserve today.
I think that is a perfect note to end. Atisa, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Who knew that out of voice, loyalty, and exit would be this stupid, but that's where we're at.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank you for taking us on a tour of the Hidden Globe.
My pleasure.